Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello there, and welcome to All Things Therapy. I am so happy to be with you, whether you are watching on Facebook Live, on Instagram, or streaming audio from everywhere podcasts are found. I hope this 45 minutes finds you well. And I'd love for you to rate and review my podcast if you have not already. All Things Therapy on iTunes and where podcasts are found. I've been getting better at asking for what I need because I think it's a skill that we can always cultivate, especially as adults. And it ties into my guest today and his book having to do with perfectionism, who I'm going to bring on in a few moments. But I think those of us that have struggled with perfectionism and doing our best, but sometimes never quite feeling like it's enough, which really speaks to we don't feel like we're enough, which is such an untrue myth that my guest is going to debunk for us today, that asking for help. So I'd really enjoy your help and some great reviews, authentic reviews of this show. Reach out to me if you're looking to work with a licensed healing practitioner. I'm licensed in California and Louisiana as a clinical social worker. I'm doing Zoom and Skype and FaceTime sessions with people all over the world. Don't hesitate to reach out if you're struggling with perfectionism, anxiety, or depression. NOLATherapy.com is my website. It's the abbreviation for New Orleans, Los Angeles Therapy, and shoot me an email, give me a text. I'd love to help work with you on whatever is challenging you today. It's been an intense year, and we're still evolving and growing and changing, and the mission of my show is changing consciousness, one conversation at a time. I love doing that through this work as a podcaster, as well as at the individual level with you. So please reach out. I also offer an online class having to do with empowerment, sourcing from within ourselves and bringing forth our natural innate gifts and abilities that sometimes it just takes us believing in ourselves some more. So again, NOLATherapy.com, NOLA Therapy on Instagram and Facebook. And lastly, having to do with me before we get to my guest is my book that dropped, The Chiron Effect, Healing Our Core Wounds Through Astrology, Empathy, and Self-Forgiveness. It is available everywhere books are sold, online, as well as at Barnes & Noble, the brick and mortar Barnes & Noble stores, which is so awesome, and on Audible, Audible. If you like audiobooks like I do, they actually sponsor this podcast and they will give you a free audiobook download of your choice to try them out. And you can take advantage of that if you're not already a subscribing member by going to audibletrial.com/allthingstherapy. As well as Amazon Music, who supports this show, you can download a free month of music by going to getamazonmusic.com/ATT. They have over 70 million songs to choose from. And if you enjoy this show, don't hesitate to support me through the crowdfunding campaign I have at patreon.com/allthingstherapy. There are so many creators. I support some other podcasters there that I love, like Nikki Eisenhower of the Emotional Badass podcast. There are artists and other content creators that you can look at and support for as little as a dollar a month. Okay, now the main event. There's a new book out, and this book is offering healthy coping techniques for children who struggle with being perfectionistic and for their parents. And truthfully, I was telling the author before we came live, there are things in here that resonate with me. Like, have you ever had a hard time with yourself when you make a mistake and you get really judgmental and critical? And it's really like emotional cutting. It really hurts to be that hard on ourselves. Or have you ever skipped a meal or not slept enough to get a project done? And has all this caused you to feel anxious or depressed? So you can know if you're experiencing this as an adult, it's even more debilitating for children. And Julian Reeve has written this book. He himself struggled with being a perfectionist for 40 years, and he was in the top 1% of his field. You know his work. He was the music director and conductor of the Broadway musical Hamilton, and at age 43, developed health problems that landed him a heart attack and got him to really change his life and write this book speaking to the importance of early intervention and what he himself had to learn about the downside of perfectionism and the underlying anxiety and depression that fuels it. So, Julian, I really want to welcome you for taking your time out today.
Thanks for having me, Lisa. Great to be here.
You're welcome. How are you today?
I'm great, thanks. Yeah, it's a nice and beautiful day in Los Angeles, so no complaints.
Awesome. So where do you want to start us on your book on perfectionism?
Yeah, I mean, ostensibly, this is the book that I wish I'd read as a kid. I grew up subconsciously in a very perfectionistic household. Both of my parents were successful musicians. And my mother actually was my very first piano teacher. She gave me my first lesson when I was four. And subconsciously, I basically started developing perfectionistic habits through learned behavior. I could see it subconsciously in my parents, but also because my mother was my first piano teacher, mistakes to me at that age were actually an opportunity for my mother to love me less. So suddenly I started developing the thinking that actually if I made a mistake, I would get loved less. So, of course, you start developing perfectionistic tendencies. And that can be true of kids across the board, not specific to that particular example, but it can start very young. So ostensibly, this book kind of gives children the tools to be able to deal with perfectionism in an early age.
And so I appreciate you sharing that vulnerability of the connection of, you know, receiving love and having to do it right or having to do it her way. Yep. And I think that's the messaging that can be so hurtful, is instead of being your authentic self as a child, is having to navigate how to get your needs met.
Yes, completely. And I think authenticity is something that, you know, it's very much more in the conscious mind now than it was when I was growing up. I was born in 74. So, you know, there's much more awareness around authenticity now than there was then. But it is so important. And obviously, you know, parenting can inform authenticity at that age, certainly.
And I think what you're saying, Julian, really ties into the piece around self-compassion that your book goes so deeply into. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, sure. So self-compassion is ostensibly... So Kristin Neff, who's like the leading psychologist in self-compassion, would describe it as having three components. Self-kindness, where we learn to be warm and understanding towards ourselves. Mindfulness, where we discover how to observe thoughts and feelings as they arise, but not necessarily to engage, deny, or react to them. And then there's common humanity, where we recognize that suffering and imperfection is just a part of the human experience. So those three elements kind of make up self-compassion. And the book goes a long way to, you know, first of all, we discover kind of what perfectionism is, the difference between healthy and unhealthy perfectionism. Then we kind of get into self-compassion a bit, and we teach the kids exactly what self-compassion is. And then we listen and read three stories featuring three different perfectionistic children, all experiencing slightly different things with perfectionism. And Captain Perfection then teaches those kids some really cool ways to overcome their perfectionism and to manage their behaviors. And then kind of comes the really cool part of the book, which is developing a self-compassion superpower. Mm-hmm. So Captain Perfection works with the reader to develop skills that they will be able to use in each three of those areas for self-compassion against perfectionism. And the reason why self-compassion is so important is that it's been proven to regulate the experience between perfectionism and depression. So if children learn these techniques early, then they're going to be able to steer away from the maladaptive areas and steer away from like low self-esteem, not being able to celebrate when they do well, fear of failure, all or nothing thinking, like there's only one way to do things. You know, there's a whole list of perfectionistic behaviors that can be avoided if we get in there earlier, sooner rather than later.
Will you define for us what perfectionism is as a baseline?
Yeah, I mean, perfectionism is ostensibly going out to be to achieve the very best that you can achieve. Unfortunately, it comes along with self-criticism. So the problem with perfectionism in society right now is that it's often regarded as a one-dimensional entity. So we all have an idea of what we think perfectionism is, and dependent on whether we experience it or not, or the level of experience that we have with it, we'll label it either good or bad or somewhere in the middle. And it's important to recognize that perfectionism is multidimensional. Some psychologists argue, actually, whether there's any positive aspects to perfectionism at all. Having been a perfectionist for 40 years, I actually think there are. I also think that it's important to recognize how perfectionists feel about their perfectionism. So a study I did last year proved almost overwhelmingly that perfectionists value their traits in some way, shape, or form. And so if we start using language that doesn't connect with them because we're trying to persuade them that actually there are no positive aspects to perfectionism at all, we're not going to connect with them. So I like to think, and I kind of used this on my TED talk last year, that, you know, there's an adaptive side, the positive side, which is, you know, setting high standards, very conscientious, great attention to detail, strong work ethic. But unfortunately, there's all the maladaptive stuff too, like the low self-esteem, self-deprecating humor, you know, there's a whole list there. So yeah, it's a very dense and, you know, quite tricky subject to get our heads around. But it's important that we get into the weeds and really discover how it affects us.
There is so much truth in what you just said, Julian, in a short amount of time. And I'd like to kind of tease some of that out as far as when you talked about understanding our own relationship to perfectionism and that it's not all good or bad, going back to how you mentioned moments ago, black and white thinking, and how a lot of life are shades of gray, and learning to become more comfortable with that can help with one's ability to self-soothe when things aren't going well. And I was also thinking as you were talking that there's a relationship between having a low threshold to tolerate frustration, and I think perfectionism, and then the emotional meltdown, you know, that happens within children and adults.
Yep.
And so I wondered, can you talk to us about some of that, and especially what you noticed about how we can take the positive aspects of perfectionism, doing our best, and really amplify that while minimizing the harming aspects of it?
Yeah. Now, I really love what you've just said. And I think the baseline for all perfectionists should be acceptance. The true root of perfectionism, as far as I consider it to be, is self-worth. If we value ourselves, we will naturally want to steer further away from damaging perfectionistic tendencies. Acceptance is huge. And how we can begin to kind of really get into the weeds of how perfectionism affects us is simply by education. And you can start with a really simple exercise and start with a pros and cons list. How does perfectionism affect you? So get a diary, get a notepad, get a piece of paper, whatever that looks like. And for 2 weeks, carry it with you and just kind of note perfectionistic behaviors. Get into the detail of exactly what it is, when it occurred, because the when and the what will help us really kind of figure out the triggers for what actually gets us to that point. In terms of being able to manage perfectionism successfully and looking at healthy versus unhealthy, what I've just talked about the pros and cons list, actually really helps us, because by identifying the pros and cons, we really identify our perfectionistic values. And so we really get to the nub of, we get to the root of the parts that we consider valuable and the parts that we consider damaging. And once we have that list, we then understand the behaviors a bit more, so that then we can start to learn specific techniques that will overcome those specific behaviors.
And Julian, how do we introduce this to our children? I know you have a daughter. How does, if someone's listening, like, oh my gosh, this would be so helpful for my son, my daughter, where might they start?
Yeah, sure. I'm actually not a parent, but the book is full of this stuff. And okay. I've done a huge amount of research to know that, you know, kids will experience the examples that I've put in the book. And, you know, a great place to start in the home, certainly for parents, is, you know, realize that when a child is in the middle of a perfectionistic episode, they are not able to rationalize with anything that you're saying in that moment. It's important that for parents to understand that. So, you know, if you're a parent and your child has made a mistake, let's say on an art project, and the world has ended and they're rolling around on the living room floor in floods of tears, and we've all seen it, and it's a horrible place to be, and you don't want your child to be in that level of pain, it's important just to understand that actually the important thing to do at that moment is just to connect with them to calm them down. Mm-hmm. So it's not a, you know, phrases like, well, it looks great to me, or, well, you tried your best and that's all you can, you know, it's not going to land. It's not going to sit. So just get in there and do what every great parent does. And, you know, you'll know your child in terms of how to calm them down. But later on, you can kind of treat it as a kind of teaching moment. And I think at that point, we spoke earlier on about vulnerability. When you're kind of teaching or coming with your child to talk about what happened, try and figure out why it happened, but also be mindful of the fact that, you know, there is a chance that for whatever reason your child is picking up on or is learning behaviors that he's picking up on in the home. So it could be, you know, that vulnerability from parents is super valuable. As in, the more you can be vulnerable with your child, the less they will put you on a pedestal, the less they will feel the need to be perfect themselves to live up to your expectations. And so in that learning moment, you can actually consciously draw from your own experience, from maybe your own childhood. Oh, well, you know, I used to make all sorts of mistakes when I was a child in art projects. It sounds simple, but that level of connection for a child is huge, because they haven't yet developed developed in ways that we now understand as adults. And so if they're actually able to develop on your level because they appreciate that you were once at where they are, then there's really great opportunity for growth and steering away from the kind of negative aspects of perfectionism.
I think that's so accurate what you're saying about the first step is to help your child self-soothe, because that's something children learn. We're not born with the ability to self-soothe. As babies, we have to be soothed by a caretaker, by parents. And then as we develop, it's about teaching those self-management skills. And you use the word mindfulness. How can we teach children mindfulness?
Yeah, so mindfulness in the book, I actually... This is a really great technique that I've actually used myself and continue to use. When children are in perfectionistic episodes, they're often either in the past or in the future. So they're rarely in the present. They're either worrying about what's happened or what might happen. And so bringing them back to the present is super important. And mindfulness can be really great with that. And the example in the book is something I've used a bunch, which is simply just to have the child notice what is around them. So what is in their peripheral vision? So for me right now, I have two lights on stands. I have a piano. I have a wall. I have a door. I have a Christmas wrapping paper. I have, and then get into the detail of exactly what more detail of.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply. You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Those specific items, so the lights are black on black stands, they've got cables coming out of them, etc., etc. And the more detail you go into and the longer you spend with this exercise, the more your child is pulled back into the present and away from the future or the past, which allows basically a reset. And that's a really valuable tool to kind of, you know, overcome those perfectionistic times so that then you're able to press reset and actually have the discussion of why it happened in the first place.
That's so good, Julian, because in the therapy world, what you're talking about is called containment. Okay. And our ability to contain our emotions and self-soothe. And even working with myself, I specialize in adolescents and adults, and so much of my work is teaching adults how to self-soothe when things upset them, when something doesn't go as expected. And it all really has to do with our own central nervous system and how to manage it by what is happening in between our two ears and what we're telling ourselves about what's happened, the stories that we create around our lives, that narrative we have control over to change instead of, you know, say observing what is. It's about, you know, using the imagination. And you talk about that visualization in your book, even with kids. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, I mean, this was, I kind of took visualization from a story that I probably learned in my late 30s from the footballer Pele. Pele was one of the most famous footballers ever written, soccer player, played for Brazil, arguably one of the best players in the world. And he used to visualize before every match. So whilst there was kind of chaos going on in the changing room before the game with all of his teammates, he was lying down on his back with his eyes closed, visualizing the game that he wanted to play. So he was regulating his body through breathing, and he was regulating his mind to be able to go out and be the genius that he was. And visualization is such a powerful tool for perfectionists, because, you know, what we think is perfect in a moment can be driven by so many different things that actually can be drivers that aren't true, that are drivers that actually don't need to be adhered to at all, can be drivers that actually we have no value to. Mm-hmm. So the more we're able to kind of visualize, bring ourselves back to the present, then we're in a better place to be able to judge whether this is actually something we want to be perfect at or not.
And it does start with, like you were saying a few minutes ago, teaching children and teaching ourselves. I had to learn myself when I started to feel really anxious. It usually meant I'm going too far out in the future than yep. what I have the ability to vision or cope with or imagine. And it was literally sitting here and saying, look, there's the red couch. And it might sound silly to you listening at first, but I encourage you to try it because it helps bring you back to the moment. Like I'll like knock on my desk, like wooden desk, red couch, and like start breathing with that. If you're in your car and you're in traffic, and some people escalate emotionally up to and including road rage, it's really about like steering wheel, grip the steering wheel, put a window down, like starting to breathe in a slower rhythm can help your body start to relax and calm down. And it's so important to teach your children these skills, because as we get older, we tend to stay rooted in what we know, and it can just get so much worse. The consequences of a meltdown as a child, you know, looks can be so problematic as an adult. So it's just really important what you're saying, to ground yourself in the room by looking at objects and even saying them out loud. I'll have my clients say, you know, what do you see sure. in front of you? And it helps.
Mm, absolutely. And, you know, I love what you just said about breath until it was too late. You know, I had a heart attack at the age of 43, which is way too young for a heart attack. And, you know, ostensibly that was born out of some, shall we say, dubious lifestyle choices in my 20s and 30s that was driven by my perfectionism. But much of how I learned to kind of navigate my perfectionism after the heart attack when I was still working on Hamilton was the realization that breath in stressful situations is huge. I actually had somebody assess me whilst I was performing, and I had gotten into such kind of bad techniques and bad habits with performing, and kind of my fight or flight mode was kind of always on, to the point that I would hold my breath whenever I was conducting or playing piano. And of course, that's a bit like, you know, not putting any oil into a car engine. If you haven't got any oil running around keeping all those parts lubricated, then you're kind of screwed. Yeah. So the power of breath is huge in all sorts of areas. And I actually make it a point now to do 10 minute breath work before I do anything during the day. I always make sure I'm out of bed, but whether that's before yoga or before emails, whatever that looks like, it's simply getting the breath going, because, you know, all of that breathing calms us down. You know, the parasympathetic nervous system switches on, leads to higher creativity, you know, all of that stuff. And it's super important.
Okay. I was curious to ask you about, here you are doing Hamilton. Amazing. Love it. As all my friends who are listening do. So thank you for that. As I said before we came live. So what happened for you? Heart attack at 43 is terrifying.
Yeah, sure. So I worked on the Broadway production in 2016. And then they asked me to take out the first national tour at the top of 2017. We started in San Francisco. This was actually before we moved to LA. This is why my wife and I moved West Coast from East Coast, because we were at the Pantages for 5 months. But prior to that, we opened in San Francisco, and 3 months into the tour, I was walking home up a hill and I had a heart attack. I had a heart attack on Friday night. It wasn't one of those kind of, you know, overly dramatic ones you see on the TV. It was all very strange, and I was sweating and couldn't breathe and I was in pain, but it wasn't collapsed to the floor or anything like that, to the point where I actually, you know, went to bed. I actually conducted the matinee the following day.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't do the show on Saturday evening because I felt so unwell, and ended up taking myself to the hospital on the Sunday morning, and that's when it was diagnosed. So yeah, right coronary artery was 90% blocked, hanging on by a thread, according to the cardiologist. And that's when I kind of really jumped into some work with a really great psychologist up in San Fran, Michael Klein, who really changed my life by introducing me to self-compassion, because it was through those sessions that we really understood that my perfectionism was really the kind of bottom line cause for the heart attack.
Wow. And had you meditated or practice any of those mindfulness techniques prior to working with him? Okay. How was it for you to add that to your life?
Well, at first, difficult, because the thing that really opened my eyes and kind of broadened my horizons into the power of all of what we're talking about was the book, The Gifts of Imperfection by Brené Brown. Just to buy the book took me weeks. Okay. Because it had the word imperfect in the title. Mm-hmm. And I just, the thought of embracing imperfection was something that I was like, well, how can I do that? I'm, you know, the boss of the biggest musical on the planet right now. The press is high. The standards are even higher. I need to maintain this level of stress to be able to get all of the same standards. But I realized kind of, you know, not too soon after buying the book, that actually there are many cool ways that we can kind of almost play with our perfectionism to, massage it so that you're able to still demand the high standards that you demand of yourself and of others, but you just do it in kinder ways. And that's when really I started to dig much deeper into the self-compassion element. Just the general awareness of breath work and meditation and yoga, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, and what you're saying, Julian, really leads right into the paper I'm holding in my hand, where you talk in your work, and I referenced it in the introduction, saying about debunking myths around self-compassion and such. You talk about there are these five key points where you talk about self-compassion is more than just being kind to yourself, that the practice of self-compassion doesn't make us weak or lazy, that self-compassion actually makes us more productive. No one's perfect, and the journey is as important as the destination. Mm. Which, can you speak about what resonates for you around these areas?
Well, yeah, sure. So the journey being as important as the destination was actually probably the most interesting and detailed journey that I had with Hamilton. Because, of course, you know, my job was performance-based, and so therefore it's results-based. And so I go to work every night and I'm asking the cast to sing all the right notes in the right order, in the right key, with all the right lyrics, and I've got to dance at the same time, and et cetera, et cetera. And then I've got the musicians to look after, and then I've got me to look after. Of course, the focus is on the product that you're trying to achieve, in this case, the destination. But I always used to kind of, before the heart attack, I always denoted whether a performance of Hamilton was perfect, simply on what I've just discussed, on right notes, on whether people had made any mistakes, whether the intention was good, et cetera, et cetera. But I realized that actually there are different ways to assess what perfection actually is. Yeah. And, you know, ultimately, if I've got 2,500 people sat behind me screaming, enjoying the show, I've got 2,500 people that all think perfection is something different. We all have an idea of what perfection actually is.
Absolutely.
So once you realize that, you begin to realize that what you're trying to attain is completely unachievable, because you're never going to please everybody. So that reduces one kind of level of stress or a driver of stress. I managed to get to the point where I would regard a performance of Hamilton being successful or perfect on the level of experience from A to Z rather than A to B, to C, to D. Okay. So rather than thinking, okay, we've just played the overture, there wasn't an overture in Hamilton, so we've just played Alexander Hamilton, we're just about to go into Aaron Burr, then we're just about to go into My Shot, I would, at the end of each number, go, well, was that perfect? Okay, great, let's keep going, let's keep going. And at some point, invariably, there would be, well, no, that wasn't, et cetera, et cetera. But the global perception of perfection is really interesting. Because what it does is it opens up a whole new level of connection. So rather than thinking too detailed about whether the notes were correct, whether people were singing the right lyrics, it became much more about feeling and how connected we all were. So it became much more, okay, well, I've played all the right notes, but did I lean into the experience of being in something? Because perfectionism often prevents us from truly being in something. Yes. Because we're too busy trying to perfect it. Yeah. So if you try and peel away that layer of the onion, then actually you're into the core a bit more. And ironically, you're able then to feel freer, which, that talking of irony, stops you making mistakes because you're not thinking about making mistakes. So because you're freer, you're truer to your authentic self, which means you are expressing yourself in the way that you were employed to express yourself, which means the audience is having a better time. And just being able to do that was a really powerful thing. And I got to the point, I was conducting a performance of the show at the Kennedy Center in DC. And I got to the place where I was so in such a meditative state that I basically watched myself conduct the show. Yeah. And I was about 3 feet above myself. And I was able to see in front of me, to the side of me, and behind me. So I could see the audience even as I'm watching the stage. And it was such an incredibly powerful experience, but all really born out of forcing myself into the middle of something through my authentic self, looking at perfectionism from a different, through a different lens.
Again, what you said in that short amount of time, so powerful. The themes I'm thinking of, you're discussing redefining perfectionism, mm-hmm. one, and the experience you described of being able to step back and observe oneself with like taking in the whole thing, really tapping into one's intuition versus having to kind of grind it out, effort it out. And like you said, was that right? Like trying to micromanage
right.
all of these people that come together to be Hamilton, impossible, like you said, versus the general feeling tone of the experience. And even hearing the cheers, obviously people are loving it. So maybe you can start to love it a little more too. Feel more guided and directed as you described versus like that high anxiety that really takes you out of knowing what needs to happen in the moment.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, certainly when you're a leader, and this speaks to a lot of the work that I do in the business field, when you're a leader, you feel a certain level of responsibility, obviously, because you have a level of responsibility. But the key is to recognize when you're taking that level of responsibility too far through perfectionism, because you're taking yourself away from your true self. And so therefore, you're not leading authentically. So nobody will follow you authentically because they're being led by something that they shouldn't be led by. But I mean, that takes a long time. And, you know, I'm still not fully there with all that stuff. But it's a powerful kind of concept. And to kind of look through perfectionism in a kind of redefined way.
Yes.
Through that lens is actually really powerful, because you can then start to basically achieve the same results in healthier ways, which is kind of the baseline of my whole ethos on the subject.
And you know, it's one of the biggest myths that we only perform well through criticism and judgment, when it's truly from like a coaching, a supportive, like, hey, you got this. Come on. All right. There's going to be another opportunity to practice this using reflection, reflecting on what happened, what you might have done differently, and knowing you'll have the opportunity to do it differently from more of a coaching mindset.
Yeah. Again, you know, it was this experience through the heart attack that really made me realize that as a musician, I was ostensibly an athlete. I'd never really thought of myself as an athlete before, but, you know, we are, those of us who work in kind of high pressure, high performance jobs, we're all athletes. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting that the athletes are very, you know, very able and willing to say that they have a coach. Whereas I find the kind of nuance in language that, you know, outside of sports, you know, we tend to veer towards teachers or educators as titles, but actually they're all the same thing. They're all coaches, but we don't think of them as coaches, to your point, in certain industries, because we're so hardwired to believe that actually, you know, whipping results out of either ourselves or other people is the only way to do it. It's a really interesting concept. Again, it's all to do with the reframing.
It is. And the themes that your book talks about, that we're discussing, and that you're doing now as a public speaker, this is a lifelong journey. The reframing of perfectionism, learning to be an encouraging coach to ourselves, to our children. It's like an endless journey as I see it. I'm curious what it's been like for you to transition into a speaking career, TEDx talk, and helping businesses and people adapt some of these principles.
Yeah, it's been great. I think the hardest thing for me is that I've had to accept that vulnerability is truth, and truth is value. And you know, Brené Brown again was a big kind of catalyst for me with all of that sort of stuff. And I think the hardest thing I've found is that, you know, I cannot be true to other people and their journey without being true to myself. But obviously I have to be very, very open with others on my journey along the way. And, you know, when you're learning new things, when you're discovering new things, as, you know, every coach, every therapist, you know, we're all learning all of the time.
Yeah.
Just that realization, which, you know, let's face it, is a fundamentally different aspect from where I've been for 30 years of my career. I spent 30 years of my career in these are the notes, play them in the right order, do that again tomorrow. Oh, and by the way, you've got 60 other people to look after. The workspace that I now work in is fundamentally the opposite of that thinking. But I think that's actually why I enjoy it so much. And it's also why I think I'm not blowing my hand trumpet, but I kind of quite good at it, certainly connected with it, because I've been able to see both sides. I've sat both sides of the fence. But you're absolutely right in saying it's a lifelong journey, and it's a lifelong journey for the teacher as well as the student.
It is. And I think affirming ourselves is a beautiful way to shift perfectionism and really ease into self-compassion, you know. So I think it's really wonderful to affirm our strengths and what we're doing well, that I think there's not enough of that. Again, you know, it really starts to be the flip side of the coin to self-deprecation and criticism, the self-affirmation and praise, and praising others. When you see someone doing something well, to let them know that, instead of just keep it to yourself.
Yes. And, you know, I love what you just said about praising others too, because this comes up in the book. You know, the common humanity element of self-compassion is so important to recognize. I mean, I find it fascinating that we're all very, very able, or mostly very, very able to show empathy and sympathy and compassion to other people. But the mirror, the minute we put a mirror up and we're forced to kind of try and treat ourselves in the same way, we find it really difficult. So the book actually encourages developing that language, thinking of your best friend. So I can't, it might have been Alexis, one of the kids in the book. Captain Perfection works with her and kind of, you know, gets her to develop that language by thinking of her best friend, Emily. Well, what would you say to Emily in this situation? And then you say, well, now use the same words, but say it to yourself. And that's a really great way to kind of develop that sort of language, is think of your best friend or a parent or anyone that you care about. What would you say to them in a moment, a tricky situation, a difficult emotional moment? Show them all the love, all the support, all the care that you would. but then actually realize that you're really talking to yourself. And it doesn't take long if you keep practicing that to really start developing some really important and integral language that will keep you going for the rest of your life, really.
Absolutely, yes. And that is the way to really think of what would I tell someone else I love and care about that's doing something amazing, doing something awesome, and say that exact thing to yourself.
Yeah.
It's so important.
But it sounds so simple. It's almost like, well, that really can't be how we suddenly develop self-compassion. And certainly it's not the only way. But self-compassion, the more you dig into it, the more you realize that the power of self-compassion is actually the simplicity. It's just that we become, as a human race, the older we get in life, I think the further away we get from simple truths. And so much of self-compassion is all about simple truth. And so really it's not learning something new. It's reconnecting with something that we've forgotten.
Yeah. Julian, there's a question from a listener that just typed in.
Yeah.
What age is the earliest to start with your techniques?
The book aims at kind of 6-year-olds and up. It's not to say that you couldn't start to implement many of the techniques. In fact, probably all of them at an earlier age. It was just where I kind of, decided through my research that this would be best pitched. But certainly what we spoke about earlier in terms of the relationship between yourself and your child, it's never too early to be on the, get yourself on the same level as your children in terms of vulnerability, and get them understanding and appreciating that you're not perfect, that actually it's not all about the results too. That's important. Celebrate the journey as well as the result, if not more so. And I think you can do that softly and slowly from even younger than 6.
I agree as well. And it's never too early and it's never too late. These principles in your book, they are evergreen. They are what today we can adopt as an adult every day, especially during this intense year where people, have found it harder to cope because they have less access to what they used to have access to. So we have to rely on more internal self-soothing, self-talk, and whatever is negative has definitely come to the forefront in this period of time. So your book is just as useful for adults.
Yeah, well, thank you. The reviews have been lovely. And to your point, pretty much every parent has said, I've got as much out of this as my child has, which is great.
It's so good. So I have 2 websites I found for you. One is captain-perfectionism.com, where it's a really great website. There's actually some swag you offer, things people can buy that are so cool for kids. And then julianreeve.com. Are those the best ways for people to reach out
to you? Yeah, absolutely. It's captain-perfection.com and then julianreeve.com. Yeah, thank you.
And on Instagram, you're at julian.reeve. And on Facebook, at julianreeve0804.
Correct.
And I'm going to tag you in everything so people will have that.
Amazing. Thank you.
Yeah. Julian, thank you for being my guest. I love your book. I've loved this conversation. And it's such a pleasure and honor to meet you.
Absolutely. You too. Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
That concludes today's show with Julian Reeve. And what did I want to say? I'm stumbling on my words. This was episode 246. Thank you so much for being here. All of my love to you, and I'll be back with you next week.
You're listening to All Things Therapy with Lisa Tahir, only